Tuesday, it's lunchtime, which means you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. This is the only show in the country where we get an entire hour where we can just talk about books and books and books. We've got a ton of fantastic reviews of new books on the shelves, international and local, fiction and nonfiction. And at the end of the show, we've got two incredible author interviews to share with you. One is an international book and the other one is a local book. So we've got a really good balance. And all of these books are going to be bookended by some very fine music because, after all, you are tuned into Fine Music Radio. We're going to start the show with Vanessa Levenstein chatting about a novel called The Household by Stacey Halls. This is an easy read. This is fantastic fiction. After that, we're joined by Shirley Guler, who reviews a book called We Rip the World Apart by Charlene Carr. Next, we've got a real treat. Beverly Rose Miller chats about the new Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel. It's called Until August. This has been much awaited in the literary community, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what Bev thought of this one. And then another treat, Melvin Minar joins us next because there is a new Sven Axelrod novel out. So this is Sven's second novel. His first novel called Buried Treasure, we gave a lot of airtime on the show because it was one of my favorite novels that I read last year. Sven Axelrod is a fantastic local author. He's got a very unique voice, and I haven't read God's Pocket yet, but it's next up on my to-read pile. He is a very deep thinker. These novels are slightly different. They're quite dark. They're quite sexy. So if you're a literary reader with interesting tastes in novels, then this might be one for you. So listen out for Melvin Minar's review of the new Sven Axelrod, God's Pocket. After that, we turn to Rachel van der Pfeffer, who is our local YA book reviewer. That's young adult. And she's going to review two books, Keedy by Ellie McNichol and The Louis Ortega Survival Club by Sonora Reyes. Interestingly, and we'll talk about this a little bit more before the review, but both of these books feature neurodiverse protagonists. So there is an interesting connection between these two novels, these two YA novels. After that, we turn to our nature section, and John Hanks will be reviewing Hiking the Fish by Henk Blankenberg and Lizette Mayer. So if you're a hiker, if you like to get out and about in our country, then I think this is one to listen out for. Then we move on to the second half of our show, which is all about the interviews. We've got two powerhouse interviews for you today. First, Beryl Eichenberger is going to interview Candace Carty Williams about her new novel called People Person. Candace Carty Williams is a very well-known British author. She's won the Book of the Year Award, and she has a lot of other accolades behind her name. We'll talk about that a little bit before the review. And then finally, we wrap up the show with Twangie Kalula, our old favorite. And just in time for voting, he's going to tell us about a book called How to Fix a Country, 6 Things to Reboot SA by Roy Haverman. And this one has a foreword by Tito Mboweni. I don't know, do we not need maybe more than 6 things to reboot South Africa? But I guess these are the 6 biggies. And then that'll wrap up the show. As I said, all of our reviews and interviews will be bookended by some very fine music, all of which was curated and selected by Mzu Makeda, and for that we are very grateful. We love your tunes, Mzu. So let's start with 2 reviews before we head into our first track. The first is by Vanessa Levenstein, and this is of a book called The Household by Stacey Halls. This sounds like an excellent read.
Give me a book that has anything to do with Charles Dickens, be it biographical or work based on his fiction, and you've got me at Charlie. Happily, all the Dickens-related books I've read have been fantastic. Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead, Zadie Smith's The Fraud, Claire Tomalin's Charles Dickens A Life, and now The Household, Not All Who Are Fallen Want to Be Saved by Stacey Halls. The Household is based on real events. Charles Dickens set up Urania Cottage, a home for women who'd been in prison or had fallen in other ways. It was hoped that this lifeboat would lead to their reform, and then quite literally they'd sail away to Australia to begin a new life. Dickens is not the main character here in this novel. It's the women, and all of them, regardless of social class, have suffered trauma, loss, and have been the victims of greed, abuse, and manipulation. The money from Urania Cottage came from the philanthropist, Angela Burdett Coutts. Angela was the richest heiress in England, but her influence and wealth wasn't enough to protect her from a psychopathic stalker, a man named Richard Dunn. The law could do nothing to protect her. Sounds familiar? Neither the law nor society were on the side of women. It's estimated that 80,000 women were prostitutes, and married women were the property of their husbands. Back to actual property, Urania Cottage. We are introduced to the first woman who arrives at the house, Martha. Mr. Dickens asked what she would make of becoming a servant. She replied that she was not afraid of labor, and then somehow revealed it stilled her mind. He appeared to like this and made a note of it on pale blue paper edged with gold. Martha's story is closely interlinked with that of her benefactor, Angela. Both refined women who were deeply moral in the true sense of the word, altruistic, but on either side of the socio-economic divide. What makes this an empowering read is that all the women were determined to be agents of their own destiny. The stakes are high because a wrong footing can lead to life back on the streets, imprisonment and death. Josephine, who spent time in prison, is prepared to forsake the comfort of Urania Cottage to find her beloved Annie. Martha is prepared to risk it all in the search for her missing sister. Their struggles are real. Clearly, the hounding of women, think the Princess of Wales, past and present, started long before the paps and social media. Angela says, "I cannot go to the park." "Why not?" he asks innocently. "Oh, do not be obtuse. If everyone knows my business, I shall be gawped at like a spectacle in a sideshow." Stacey Halls plunges the reader into events, different locations and timelines, and presumes they'll keep up, which is engaging for the reader. The subtitle to The Household gives us a clue to the writer's intentions. Not all who are fallen want to be saved. We know only too well the savior mentality. Think about the missionaries and the so-called heathens. Of course the women in Victorian England wanted a better life, but they didn't want to be infanticized and lose agency. Stacey Hall names her characters after Dickens's characters, and Dickens, with his pale blue paper edged with gold, takes detailed notes of the women's past. A ledger, he calls it. Cynics may call it research. This isn't another Demon Copperhead, nor does it pretend to be, but The Household is a well-researched, well-written novel that links our past to our present and delves deeply into place, time, and character.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. I'm always a big fan of your reviews, and you and I kind of read similarly. So I'm curious about this one. I'm going to put it on my ever-heaving to-read list that I will never, ever, ever get to the bottom of. Next up, we're joined by Shirley Guler, who's chatting about a novel called We Rip the World Apart by Charlene Carr. Welcome to the show, Shirley.
Here's another book that makes you think. A story that travels from Toronto to Halifax to Jamaica and back and tackles so much about relationships, politics, racism, abuse. Even before the novel, We Rip the World Apart, begins, you are gripped by a warning that you may need to put this book down to process your emotions. Then you know you are in for a deeply disturbing and profound read, and that's absolutely correct. Of course, being very familiar with the layout of Halifax in Canada was part of the appeal, but that has nothing to do with the intrinsic value of the message. There are mainly two authorial voices. White Evelyn, who fled an abusive father for Kingston, where she married a black man, then fled the chaos and dangers of Jamaica for Toronto, and Karela, her daughter, biracial and conflicted. The novel is about choices, always choices, protest versus negotiation, standing up and possibly face death, or lying down and face one's conscience. Abortion or simply having a baby in a relationship that's not right is another choice. White friends or black friends. And it's about complexities. Canadian author Charlene Carr fits them all neatly into a fast-moving story, one in which a black person is at risk simply because he or she is black. But back to basics. Jamaica or Canada? You'd think Canada was a safer option, but with a growing awareness of one's rights as a black person and continuing trouble with the police, this isn't so. The kind of protection that white police get or used to get in America is well documented. That in Canada, less so. So this was a shock. The loss of son and brother Anthony, shot by police during a protest when he was gutsy and innocent, changed their lives forever. And Karela, who was a child, is profoundly affected later in life at the age of 24. As silence has become too big for the space, so Carr reveals more and more about events that shaped Evelyn, who has a fractured relationship with both her mother-in-law, Violet, and her daughter. She dissects the character of Violet, who came from Kingston to take care of Evelyn's family, and she had her own tragedies and loss of children. And of course, she is also complicated and scarred, but it is Karela, on the threshold of a new life, who needs to understand her mother's seeming inability to love. If you want to know more about how people cope in today's world in an interracial marriage with biracial children, read this. It's worth it.
Welcome back. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. That track was Walking on Sunshine by the Cape Town Philharmonic Orchestra, and we've only just begun our show. We still have a ton of great stuff for you. Next up is a review that I've really been waiting for. In fact, we've been waiting for this book for a very, very long time. Beverly Ruiz Miller is going to review the new Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel. It's called Until August, and this is called The Lost Novel. So people have been waiting for this for a long time. There's always that debate about whether to posthumously publish books against an author's wishes. So let's hear about it. Bev, was this one, were they right to publish this one, or should they have held on to it?
I admired this little book each day as it lay on my desk. It is as exquisite as a jeweled brooch, colors bright and bountiful, something to cradle and stare at with pleasure. It is Until August, the last story by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, his so-called lost novel. If you are a fan of Gabo, as he was known, you will know that his beloved books excavate the themes of love and death and passion so grandly, so profoundly, that the Colombian was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1982. And is likely one of the best-known laureates of the 20th century. Love in the Time of Cholera and 100 Years of Solitude are most often noted as his finest work. Yet I also love his non-fiction writing, for he had been a journalist too, and his rich and frank memoir, Living to Tell the Tale, is one of my personal favorites. Late in life, he developed dementia. Aware of this, he did not stop writing, for no born writer can do that. Yet he was worried about the quality of his work. He wrote several short novels that were to be part of a collection, but remained unsatisfied with the work and left instructions for it to be destroyed. Yet his sons decided to publish Until August, and I am glad that they did. Let's not quibble about whether it was his great work or not. I read it for the essence of what he searched for, what he cared about, what he was alive and sensitive to. This is the story of a married, maturing woman. Many reviews use that dull phrase, middle-aged, whose body takes on an adventure of its own once each year in August, when she takes a ferry to a distant island to lay gladioli on the grave of her mother, who had insisted on being buried there. Anna Magdalene Bach encounters, on her 8th annual trip in August, a handsome man in a bar, and having up until now been a faithful spouse, she has a superbly satisfying one-night stand with this exquisite lover, flaming her passion and sense of adventure. Yet the next morning she is dismayed to find he has slipped a $20 bill into his bedside book. Was this merely a paid-for transaction for him, despite it being so intensely pleasurable for herself? Years pass as she returns each August to spread more gladioli on the grave and to find another lover with varying degrees of success. She reaches 50 and wonders if her husband too is embarking on his own adventures, and then she discovers why her mother had insisted on being buried there and what a legacy it had left her. To publish or not, against the author's wishes, there have been notable disasters. John le Carré's last book, Silvermine, was a travesty. Even worse was the decision by publishers to bring out a prequel to one of the best books of all time, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. On the other hand, Kafka ordered his material to be destroyed, and by not doing so, his great novel, The Trial, was saved. None of these quibbles mattered to me. I read this book as a praise song to women's sexuality and passion, of regret for what we have missed and should not have. Love in the Time of Aging could have been its title too. That thing that society turns away from as years march on, yet at no age does the heart not yearn, and very often the body too. Until August felt like Garcia Marquez's last gift to me. Highly recommended.
Thank you so much, Bev. It's fascinating. Next up, we have another biggie that I've been very much looking forward to. Melvin Minar recently read Sven Axelrod's second novel called God's Pocket. If you're a regular listener of the show, you might remember that Melvin Minar actually interviewed Sven Axelrod last year on the show about his debut novel, which was called Buried Treasure, which we all really enjoyed. And then as soon as they announced that Sven Axelrod was bringing out his second novel, God's Pocket, Melvin leapt into my email inbox and he said, I bags that one, I want to read that one, and I want to review it. So we're all racing each other to get to read this book. I haven't gotten there yet, but it's on my pile coming up next, and I'm really looking forward to reading it. So Sven Axelrod, he's a literary author. His books are quite different, quite dark. He covers sex and religion. They're very deep and they're beautifully written, and I highly, highly, highly recommend them. I think this is one South African author to watch. I think he's got a very big and long career ahead of him. And I do recommend that you pick up Buried Treasure, which is his first novel, and the second one, God's Pocket. I don't believe that you need to have read the one in order to read the other. I think they have similar themes, but I don't think that they're direct sequels. Melvin, tell us all about Sven Axelrod's much-awaited God's Pocket.
The Winelands Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Richard Keen, takes you on a musical journey across magnificent mountains. Our concert, Autumn Peaks, includes Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring and Franz Krommer's sensational double clarinet concerto. The soloists are Berdine Goldstone and Christy Boenzaar, whose composition, A Aunt op Simonsberg, will also be played. Autumn Peaks takes place on the 1st of June at 7 p.m. at the Endler Hall in Stellenbosch as part of the Endler Concert Series. Bookings through web tickets.
The Cape Town Music Academy presents master saxophonist Makoi Nkubatsa's homecoming concert. This jazz legend will be joined on stage by American Gary Whitner on guitar, with Cape Town Sibusiso Matsimela on bass and Tefo Mohola on drums. The concert celebrating McCoy's birthday is at the Homecoming Centre in District 6 on Saturday, 1st of June from 8 p.m. Bookings through Quicket. As a proud media partner, Fine Music Radio will broadcast this milestone performance at a later date.
At Fine Music Radio, we want to keep the music playing, not only for us, but for the next generation.
When I hear a piece of music on FMR, I want to play it myself.
I love dancing to classical music.
My favorite is ballet music on FMR.
I love FMR.
Please visit fmr.co.za and become a member so that Africa's last classical and jazz FM radio station can remain on air.
Baie dankie.
In the business of authorship, novel writing in particular, the challenge of a follow-up to a brilliant debut is daunting. And this is not only for the first-time publishing author, but no less for the expectant audience of new admirers. Let me put worrying minds at ease. Durban-based Sven Axelrad's super first novel, The Deliciously Individual and Original Buried Treasure, is succeeded by an equally fine book. Titled God's Pocket, it is as delightful in its treatment of the imaginative world as his first. No disappointment here for Axelrad fans, including this one. What is particularly exciting is that the author extends that imagined place, explored both figuratively and literally in Buried Treasure, with new characters and a different narrative game plan. Like the first novel, the title of God's Pocket plays out in various ways. The town is again a fictional vino of the mind, and bits of the previous novel come into play like smart footnotes. Yet again, the narrator appears and interrupts from time to time as an amusing know-all, stage director, or deus ex machina. Axelrad's appeal is situated in the way he leads readers into an engaging dance of his own magical realism. He triggers your imagination, interest, and invites you in. He doesn't miss a step, but constantly changes the expectation with a surprise twirl and twist. Under his spell, we all love the originality of the boogie. The story is a kind of coming-of-age love affair, and the author introduces the main characters right at the start, and I quote, "Our story begins with two young people, not adults or children, but those who inhabit the strange and exciting middle ground between the two, where life itself, via a conspiracy of hormones and nerve endings, is louder, brighter, and generally more painful." End the quote. In other words, youth is celebrated, but there is no escaping the pain of life, of living, the absurdity of existence itself. Central to the plot is a passionate artist-writer in the style of the classic romantic era. But the hard-edged theme is really a contemplation of the act of writing, of creating, of twisting, twirling, and empowering words. Philo is the aspiring young writer who, with the help of his student pals, AWOLs from the Vino University to write a novel. In the vein of the great Henry David Thoreau and his grand account called In the Woods at Walden Lake, Philo is marooned near a black lake, steep rock face, in an abandoned cabin to take on the creative typing job. The main character of his novel, Philo tells his love in the moment, called Liv, is called Sven Axelrad, a writer who isolates himself in a remote cabin to write a novel. Axelrad's self-referential element adds a wonderful spark and layer to a book that spins endlessly through the reader's imagination. This is the postmodern novel in high gear. To escape the secret hideaway, our young scribe had disobeyed his father's wishes for him to study accountancy. Axelrad himself is indeed an accountant, and the parents call in the investigator to find the son who seems to have disappeared. Philo's four friends, meanwhile, are in the throes of their own sexual and social awakenings, while colorful local Vivano personalities complicate the plot. Among them, the rambunctious The Investigator, Maria de Luz, and a dog called Maria de Pera, The Masturbator, Mighty Chango, a giant eel or lamprey, and of course, Henry, who is a dark, mysterious construct of the imagination. Sven Axelrad's love of literature shines in sparkling, witty gems referenced throughout. Like Buried Treasure, God's Pocket is showmanship of skillful literary craft, and a wickedly keen sense of smart humor seals the reading appeal. What a joy God's Pocket is. God's Pocket is published by Amuzi.
Thank you so much, Melvin. Next up, we've got Rachel van der Pfeffer, who is our resident high school student, well, not for much longer, and our young adult novel reviewer. So today, Rachel's actually going to review two books. The first one is called Keedy, and it's by L. McNichol. And the second one is by Sonora Reyes, and it's called the Louis Ortega Survival Club. So both of these books are international, both feature neurodiverse protagonists, and both have similar themes of bullying. So it's quite interesting to review them next to each other. We thought that would be an interesting exercise. Another interesting thing to note is that Kidi by Ellie McNichol was published by a publisher who set up an imprint specifically with the purpose to give a voice to writers outside of the mainstream. And even more interestingly, the author, Elle McNichol, is autistic herself. So this is a very interesting exercise. Rachel van der Pfeffer, tell us all about Kidi and the Louis Ortega Survival Club.
This month, I'll be discussing two wonderful books that both feature neurodivergent main characters, although they both have very different stories and themes and are aimed at different age groups. Kidi, by Elle McNichol, is a prequel to McNichol's 2020 book, A Kind of Spark, which was recently adapted into a TV show. It's a coming-of-age story that's set 5 years before the events of the first book and follows Kidi, an autistic girl and the older sister of A Kind of Spark's main character, Addie. After defending a girl at a party from a bully, Kidi sets up an anti-bullying agency at her school, offering her services to learners to scare the bullies away for a fee. Not so surprisingly, this lands in hot water with the school administration. Meanwhile, she also finds herself growing closer to little sister Addie and drifting away from her twin sister Nina. I love this book and absolutely raced through it. It was really, really gripping, and I finished under the covers at night. I thought the representation was done really well, and I think it'd be a great book to educate kids about neurodiversity. The author herself is neurodivergent, and this gives the book authenticity. I haven't actually read A Kind of Spark before, but I found Kidi easy to follow, and because it's a prequel, I don't think there are many references that one would miss either. I am, however, going to find a copy of A Kind of Spark to read next. On a side note, the book inspired me to look up Greenland sharks, and I discovered that they're very cool creatures. The second book, The Louis Ortega Survival Club, is just as great, but it's definitely a lot heavier of a read and aimed at an older age group of teens. After being assaulted by Louis Ortega at a party, Ariana teams up with a group of people who all want revenge on Louis, calling themselves the Louis Ortega Survival Club. Together, they set out to expose Louis and take him down. I thought the book was wonderful. It was sweet and funny in parts, but more importantly, it tackled serious and but necessary topics. Again, I thought the book did a really great job of representing neurodivergency, although in this book, it wasn't the main topic, but still an important part of Ariana's character, as she's autistic and has selective mutism. The Louis Ortega Survival Club is written by Sonora Reyes and published by Faber. Kidi, by Elle McNichol, is published by Knights of, a publisher specializing in giving a voice to neurodivergent authors.
And now to one of our very favorite segments in the show, always. John Hanks joins us with his Nature book, and he's going to be telling us about a new one that's out now. It's called Hiking the Fish, and it's by Henk Blankenberg and Lizette Mayer.
What a pleasure to review this superb guide on hiking entitled Hiking the Fish, the Ultimate Guide to the Fish River Canyon Trail. Located in southern Namibia, the canyon contains some of the most impressive vistas in southern Africa, a very special geological wonderland carved out by the once mighty Fish River and then sculpted through millions of years by tectonic forces, wind and water. The authors are Henk Blankenberg and Lizette Mayer, and they succeeded in capturing the haunting beauty of this most special part of Africa in a series of excellent color photographs with informative text on the geology and other features of Africa's largest canyon. If you are an enthusiastic hiker, then I have no doubt that this book will stimulate you to make a booking for this challenging 5-day hiking trail through the desert wilderness. But please note that completing the Fish River hike is no small feat. It's seriously rough terrain, and with a heavy backpack with supplies for 5 days and exposure to the elements, it should not be attempted by unfit or by inexperienced hikers. Equally important to note is that only 30 people are allowed on the trail per day. With bookings opening a year in advance, this will give you lots of time to prepare, and this is where this guidebook is exceptionally valuable. Prepared by veterans of the hike and taking you step by step through the entire process of preparing and planning effectively for what will undoubtedly be an unforgettable experience. Chapter 2 focuses on planning the hike, including building fitness and endurance, the best time of the year to go, the vital importance of staying cool, and some more useful guidance on mandatory forms and permits. Chapter 3 on packing the right gear should be mandatory reading for all participants, noting at the start that, and I quote, "Carrying a full backpack that is too heavy for your frame can put immense strain on your body, leading to fatigue, pain, and even injury," end quote. Which, of course, makes it much more difficult to traverse parts of the canyon's uneven terrain. This chapter also has very good advice on everything from finding the right pack for your build to ideal tents and sleeping bags, recommended footwear and clothing, what food to take, and the contents of a first aid kit. Chapter 4 has a comprehensive and very well illustrated day-by-day route description, and reading this on its own will make you want to give this one a go. The two authors are both expert and experienced multi-day hikers, ideally qualified to produce a guidebook which really is in a class of its own. The title again, Hiking the Fish, the Ultimate Guide to the Fish River Canyon Trail. The authors are Henk Blankenberg and Lizette Mayer, and it's just been published by Straight Nature, an imprint of Penguin Random House, and you can get a copy for 200 Rand.
Thank you so much, John, for telling us about Hiking the Fish here on Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. How about some music before we head into our interviews? We have Tea for Two by Crystal Burkholz. Welcome back. That was Tea for Two here on Fine Music Radio by Crystal Burkholz. And you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And of course, as always, this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books, and we are very grateful for their support. So now we go into the second half, or the end half of our show. We have two interviews coming up. The first is with Candace Carty-Williams. Now, she is a British showrunner. She's also a culture writer. She's an author of the Book of the Year award-winning novel and Sunday Times best-selling novel called Queenie. You might have heard of it. Got a lot of press. She's also written a young adult novella called Empress and Ania. So Candace Carty-Williams does a lot of writing. She's written for publications including The Guardian, ID Magazine, Vogue Magazine, Sunday Times, that'll be in the UK, Beat Magazine, and Black Ballad. And she's a contributor to the anthology New Daughters of Africa, which was edited by Margaret Busby. So she's a very well-known writer, and we're very honored to have her on the show. She's here to talk about People Person, which is her latest book. They say she's returning after she wrote that brazenly hilarious Tell It Like It Is first novel, Queenie. She's returning now with another witty and insightful novel, which is about the power of family, even when they seem like strangers. They say here, if you could choose your family, you would not choose the Penningtons. So Beryl Eichenberger was chatting to Candace Carty-Williams in the Fine Music Radio Studios. Over to you guys. Welcome to the show.
Growing up, I never felt I could write. Writing is something I came to really late. And I guess I'm still finding my confidence because I never thought it was an attainable career. These were the words of Candace Carty-Williams. But now, with a book of the year, a Sunday Times bestseller, the first black author to win top prize at British Book Awards for Queenie, a nomination for the Women's Prize for Fiction already under her belt. Both her novels, Queenie and People Person, have shown a culture writer of extraordinary talent. Very warm welcome, Candace Carty-Williams, to our FMR Book Choice studio. It's lovely to have you here.
And it's lovely to be here. Thank you.
And I'm really sorry that I didn't get to see one of your sessions at Franschhoek.
No, it's fine. Honestly, it's fine. It was so busy and so full. And, you know, we were all spoiled for choice, so.
We were.
Yes.
We were. It was great fun. So you call yourself a culture writer.
Yeah.
Give us a synopsis of what a culture writer is, because it's sort of almost a new genre, isn't it?
I think my writing just concerns culture. It concerns who I am. It concerns what I see and what I experience and what people like me see and experience. But also, I sit within a huge culture. I sit within a very expansive culture. And I feel like it's my job to document and archive that, if that makes sense through my work.
It does.
And I think that one of the things that I speak about a lot is gentrification. So it's not just personal culture, it's also geographical culture and just taking in the world around me and how it changes and how I fit within that.
And you focus on the overlooked minorities, the Caribbean community, who are wonderfully colourful and depicted so beautifully in your book. But tell me, when you found the confidence to write, when did you suddenly think, well, actually I need to write all this down? Or did you find the confidence?
You know, as a person, I'm always kind of like looking at what needs to be done. And then I'm like, well, if no one else is going to do it, I'll just do it. So I don't think it ever comes from being like, I'm going to be the best at something. But I know that I'm going to put my best into something.
Right.
And so in terms of finding confidence to be a writer, and also being a writer isn't just writing. It's also doing interviews. It's also getting on stage in a festival in Franschhoek, which is very far from home.
Huge.
You know, so it's actually a very big responsibility that goes beyond the words on the page. And so I feel like I'm always still developing and learning and finding myself in my craft. But as long as I'm doing that, it means that I'm doing well for me, I think, because I don't think anyone is ever finished, you know?
No, absolutely. So you worked in publishing.
Yes.
Was that a sort of trigger to you moving onto the writing spectrum?
It was a place that I could see what was coming in and what was being published and who was being represented. And for me, I was like, this isn't acceptable. You know, in that sort of, I was 24, 25 at the time. And in that way, I think you can be really young and be like, well, this isn't right. I'm going to fix it. And so I started a short story prize for underrepresented writers. And for me, that wasn't enough. I was like, okay, cool. I've done that. There are still stories coming through and new voices coming through. But I wanted to contribute because I was like, okay, well, this isn't happening at the speed that I would like it to. So what have I got to say? And then Queenie was born.
And you've got a lot to say.
Yes. Yes, I do. Yeah, as it turns out.
Which is
yes.
lovely. And both your character, Queenie, is quite delightful. Heartbreaking in many ways. And as is Dimple in People Person. But, you know, we always sort of say, write what you know.
Yes.
So you write about the Caribbean community, mainly in Brixton.
Yes.
Which is an area that actually I do know, have been to and all the rest of it. How did that evolve? Where did the stories come from? People Person is your latest novel.
Mm-hmm.
But who were the stories based on?
The stories were based on, I guess, like little parts of me and women that I've known, women that I've seen, women whose stories I've heard throughout my life. I'm from a family of people who love to tell stories. This is my main family, my extended family. I have friends who love to tell stories. So I guess as someone who kind of always thought of herself as an emotional archivist it's my job to sort of like listen and learn from people and sort of download it all and then think about who these people can be in the worlds that I create, because they're all real people in some way. You know, they might not be name for name, event for event, but the ways that they are, the ways that they move through the world and the ways that they are represented and feel are real to me. And so, yeah, they come from, I guess, so Queenie, you know, she's 25. She's got a lot of drive, a lot of passion. She wants to change the world. And then you have Dimple, on the other hand, who has no drive and no passion and just wants to be an influencer because she believes that...
complete opposites.
She just believes that the world will come to her, which obviously isn't true. And so it was really fun to get into the heads of different sort of main character women who have different ways of the world. And actually, because of their upbringings and because of the ways that they've seen themselves represented or have been parented.
And it's very much a sisterhood.
Yes.
You're writing about women.
Yes.
Strong women, although they don't always see themselves as strong until sort of everything falls apart and then they have to put themselves together again. What I found also very interesting is that you're dealing with mental health issues. And I feel quite strongly about that because I think it's so important that we speak about it, that it, the stigma and of course the young royal family have been speaking about it and I think made it very much more acceptable. But talk to me about Queenie's mental health issues.
So when we meet her in the novel, she's teetering on a sort of quarter life crisis. She doesn't really understand who she is, where she's going. She's just sort of having a breakup
with her boyfriend,
with her long-term partner. And this is the first time she ever felt safe. So whether or not the relationship is right for her or not, she still felt safe and felt held in this space. And so when that crumbles, everything else sort of starts to crumble around it. And so I think that in terms of identity and how people are shaped, I think my point is when you're growing up, the stuff that you have experienced and felt will kind of come at you until you've listened to it and you've sorted it out.
Right. And Dimple, of course, is different. And sadly, we are just about to run out of time, which is always the way. But what I have to say is I resonated with both the books.
Thank you.
I found the characters so very real. I mean, People Person is very much about families and relationships, families that you don't actually know you have until suddenly they all come together. So, Candace, thank you so very much for coming in today. We are published by Trapeze, People Person. And Queenie is also Trapeze.
Yes.
And is there another book in the pipeline?
There is another book in the pipeline, but also potentially a film.
Okay, great. That's for our next interview.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Candice. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
C'est si bon de partir n'importe où. Bras dessus, bras dessous, en chantant des chansons. C'est si bon de se dire des mots doux, de petits rien du tout, mais qui en disent long en voyant notre mine. Ravie les passants dans la rue nous envient. C'est si bon de guetter dans ses yeux et l'espoir merveilleux qui donne le frisson. C'est si bon ces petites sensations, ça vaut mieux qu'un million. C'est tellement, tellement bon. En voyant notre mine ravie, les passants.
passants dans la rue nous envient. C'est ces mots de gaieté dans ses yeux et l'espoir merveilleux qui donne le frisson. C'est ces mots, ces petites sensations, ça vaut mieux qu'un million. C'est tellement, tellement bon. C'est bon, ces petites sensations, ça vaut mieux qu'un million. C'est tellement, tellement bon.
That was C'est si bon by Emile Mini, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. If you miss any of the reviews or titles of books or the interview or any part of today's show and you'd be curious to go back to it, the good news is that our wonderful Mzu loads a podcast of the show onto fmr.co.za, or you can get it on the FMR app. And that's loaded shortly after the end of this show. So if you miss something, you can always listen back and find the info you need, or just enjoy listening to the show on your own time. Coming up next, we have our very last interview for the show, and that's with Twangi Kalula. Twangi Kalula is going to be chatting to Roy Haverman about his new book called How to Fix a Country, 6 Things to Reboot South Africa. And this has a foreword by Tito Mboweni. So I guess it's really good timing. We've got elections coming up. Me personally, I'm surprised there are only 6 things we need to reboot South Africa. But hopefully one of them is for everybody to get out there and vote. I like the quote on the cover. It said, "This book will leave you smarter." And Carol Payton said that. So Twangi, welcome to the show. And hello, Roy Haverman. Congratulations on your new book, How to Fix a Country. So, how can we fix this country?
So, I don't need to tell you that it's election season, and if you've attempted to read any of the manifestos, I'm sure that you'll agree that most of them are uninspiring. We've heard it all before. We all know what doesn't work. We all know how we would like things to work, but for some reason, we just can't make the leap to get there. And that is 30 years into our democracy, which is why it is refreshing to be joined by Roy Haverman. He's an economist who has detailed his ideas in plain English in a new book called How to Fix a Country, 6 Things to Reboot South Africa. I must tell you that there is an entertaining expletive in the title, but because it's daytime radio, I won't mention it right now. Thanks for joining us, first of all.
Thank you very much for having me, Tony.
And the best part of the book, it hit me really hard, is that you've dedicated the book on the first page to the millions of South Africans without jobs, and I think that really just gets to the core of where we're starting from. And I just wanted to find out what inspired you to kind of really look at the problems and then kind of come up with a plan to kind of reboot our economy, reboot our society.
Well, thanks very much. Yes, I think we all worry about the millions of people that are unemployed. I mean, you can't go a day without seeing people without work or hearing from people without work. And many other countries have been in the same situation as us, and many other countries have rebooted and done remarkable things in terms of how they have created jobs in a very short space of time by just implementing a few key reforms to get things moving.
And to your point, I mean, you look around and you see so much dysfunction around us, and I think it's very difficult because you've been in an exceptional case in many ways, but there's certain simple things that we can't get right. And what I found really fascinating about your book was just looking to other countries for inspiration. I think we don't do enough of that. Can you give us just a couple of examples of countries that are doing great things to tackle problems or have succeeded in fixing some of the problems we have?
Yes, so I look at quite a few countries. I think one of the most interesting, I think particularly at the moment, is India. In 1991, where Congress lost power, they had to end up putting together a minority government, and they barely hung on. And then they implemented a whole number of reforms in 1991, and today India is one of the fastest growing economies in the world, and millions of people have been lifted out of poverty. Other examples in South America: Bolivia has done a lot to deal with inequality, still quite poor. Colombia has done incredible things to improve safety. And China is obviously the huge example that goes right throughout the book. This reform program and these things that they did are very similar problems to what we had. And obviously millions of Chinese people have been lifted out of poverty, and China is a booming economy.
I mean, you had a huge potential, I guess, shopping list of issues you could use, you know, to whittle down to get to six things that you needed to do to reboot the country. And I'm going to give our listeners a spoiler because they are ESCOM, education, the environment, exports, equality, and the final one is creating an ethical and effective state. What made you decide on those particular six focus areas rather than the, you know, kind of millions of other issues we face, I guess?
Yes, I mean, I think this is really about the point of the book is we need to prioritize. And under each of those six things, there are one or two things we really need to do in the next year or two. So it's trying to find a way of prioritizing and prioritizing your priorities to make sure that we don't try and do an incredible number of different things because we're only going to lose focus and lose track. So those are the six.
And then in terms of the actual challenges, you delve into the challenges and your solutions are so simple. Like they just feel so straightforward and you just can't seem to get it right. So I think as a reader, I was quite frustrated at times, you know, like as you're reading it. But at the same time, you have a sense of optimism. And I guess that's encouraging because you spent so much time working as, you know, a consultant, but also working for many years within the state. What makes you feel optimistic that we can actually do this and get it right?
I think there's finally a sense of what the things are that need to be done. I think there's been huge progress on Eskom, for example. Just the other day, you know, the National Transmission Company of South Africa was created. And if you look around the world, particularly at China and Greece and Colombia, which are the three examples I use, this is how they fix their load shedding problem, is to create a state-owned company that just deals with transmission and then buys generation. So we are chipping away at the problem. There are other issues where we're not chipping away on. Education, I think, is in some ways going backwards. But in other areas, we are making progress. So it's a bit of a mixed bag at the moment. But I completely agree with you. I think that the big problem at the moment is how slow things are changing.
And the other thing that comes through in the book that's really interesting is that we've got this idea that, you know, the private sector is great and the public sector is poor. But, I mean, throughout the book, you really propose ideas that kind of encourage a partnership between the two. Has that worked elsewhere in the world? And do you think it's something we can do here and get right here?
Yes, I think that we do often just fall into this binary. And I say that, you know, the world, as we know, the kids will tell us today, is not a binary. There's no such thing as a completely state-led country anymore. It left, actually. And there's no such thing as a completely privatized country left. That would actually be, I think, in some ways a disaster in this country because of inequality. We all know the rich will just get richer and sort of take all the resources. You do need a strong and capable state that does what it needs to do but doesn't do more than that, but also does what it needs to do it properly. And I use the analogy of a birdcage where the state is the birdcage and the private sector is the bird. And if the birdcage doesn't exist, the private sector flies away and we have financial crises. But if the birdcage is too small, then the bird actually dies.
And then the other thing I didn't tell our listeners is that Roy is a very smart economist. He has a PhD, but he's managed to write a book in plain, simple English. And I was just fascinated about how you decided to pitch this book, why you decided to do that. You know, when you pick up a book like this, you always worry that you're going to be reading an academic paper, especially for someone like me who doesn't know anything about economics, I guess. Why did you decide to make it so accessible and write it that way?
I mean, I often think about the people say, who are you writing for? And I often think, you know, you go to your doctor and your doctor says, oh, what do you do? Oh, you're an economist. What should we do to fix the country? And it's a very intelligent guy. You know, he's got a medical degree, etc. But he doesn't understand economics. And it's not his fault. He's spent his life trying to understand how to fix me, not to fix the country. So you try and write in a very simple way, and it actually takes quite a long time. So it took a long time to clarify everything.
And if Roy invites you for dinner, read the book. He doesn't want to talk about economics. I'm sure now you can finally talk about something else, which will be quite refreshing. And then lastly, I think the thing that can often be frustrating for all of us as citizens is just kind of the sense of helplessness and hopelessness about the role that we play. And I was just wanted to get your view on when readers finish the last page, what do you want them to do, feel? How do you take action and, you know, contribute to rebooting?
I think people should be impatient. So I think they should hold their politicians accountable and demand that things are changed. That's how our democracy works. And we've just obviously celebrated 30 years of democracy. And perhaps we've just become too patient and we've perhaps got to the point where we've kind of given up. But I don't think we should. I think that we can make a difference and we can reboot the country.
Thank you so much, Roy. We just scratched the surface. I mean, you really have to get into this book to appreciate how simple the problems are in a sense, or the problems are complex, but the solutions are potentially simple. And I think after the elections, it'll be time to get to work. So I really encourage you to get out and read this book. It is simple, it is accessible, it is practical, and it's refreshing. How to Fix a Country by Roy Hoverman was published by Jonathan Ball and retails for 320 Rand.
And that's it for our show this week. Well, almost that's it. So before we sign off, I wanted to tell you about an upcoming week of workshop events that have caught my eye. You may have heard of the Book Lounge. Well, I hope you've heard of the Book Lounge. They are the most marvelous independent bookshop in Cape Town. And every year they run a book festival right here in Cape Town called the Open Book Festival. You really do check it out if you haven't been yet. It's a dream that this is hosted in Cape Town. But this year, in addition to the Open Book Festival, they're also hosting a workshop week, and that's coming up from the 3rd to the 8th of June. Basically, this workshop week is an extensive lineup of workshops and masterclasses specially designed to help aspiring writers of all levels, it doesn't matter where you're at with your writing journey, to help you hone your craft and develop the skills you're going to need to succeed in today's very competitive literary landscape. These workshops are going to be taking place at Bertha House, which is in Cape Town, as I said, from the 3rd to the 8th of June. Workshop Week offerings will cover a very wide range of genres and topics. It will give you unique opportunities to learn from celebrated authors, editors, even agents and industry professionals. It's a great opportunity. According to festival coordinator Frankie Murray, she says whether you're a first-time writer or a seasoned pro, there's something for everyone in this year's workshop curriculum. Workshops will focus on key areas such as fiction writing, poetry, screenwriting, and marketing. In addition to workshops, the festival features invaluable masterclasses led by best-selling authors and literary stars. These are going to be very intimate, in-depth sessions that will allow writers to receive constructive feedback on your works in progress. They also say that these workshop week tickets are now available through web tickets. I suspect they will get snapped up very fast because they only have limited spaces available. They're quite intimate, these workshops. So secure your spot as soon as you can. And with that, workshop week punt brings us to the end of this week's show. My thanks to all our reviewers, all our authors, and of course the publishers who share their books and their knowledge with us so generously. Also, a big thank you to Mzu Maketa, who pulls the show together and curates all the music we've been listening to, like this next track that we're going to be playing out with, which is Someone to Watch Over Me by Tessa. Until next time, happy reading!